I'd like to welcome to the program Jeff Thale. He's Program Director with the Washington Office on Latin America, and just returned from observing the Summit of the Americas in Panama City. Jeff, thanks so much for making the time to come on the program here after your long week there in Panama.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, say a quick word, if you would, about the work that you do at the Washington Office on Latin America.
Sure. So we're an organization that focuses on, we do research and advocacy, and we focus on human rights in the Americas. We've been around since the early 1970s, and we were formed after the coup in Chile to oppose U.S. support for the Pinochet government. So we've sort of continued, and today we work on Mexico, on Central America, on Cuba and Colombia, kind of a range of issues in the hemisphere.
So this summit meeting in Panama that you attended, it was historic. It was historic because it was the first such summit that invited Cuban government officials to participate, a change made possible by the Obama administration's move to normalize relations with Cuba in recent months. So, Jeff, maybe we could get your overview of, you know, how much that focus on the change in U.S.-Cuban relations maybe altered the atmosphere at the summit.
Well, I think it made a huge difference. I mean, you know, there was a summit, there have been seven of these summits in the Americas. At the last one in 2012, probably the majority of countries present told President Obama, both publicly and privately, that they would not come to the next one unless Cuba were invited. And so Cuba was invited. Cuba was actually invited before President Obama made the formal decision to normalize relations, but I think everybody could see that was coming. And I think it made a real change in the atmosphere. I mean, every president in the hemisphere congratulated President Obama for normalizing relations with Cuba. All of the big applause lines in the summit and in the events around it were about the normalization of U.S. relations with Cuba. So I think it made a really significant shift in the tone. And the one thing I would say is that, you know, the Obama administration really went into this looking for that kind of change in tone and the change that would help in its relations with Latin America in general. It had a little bit of a bump in the road because 2 weeks ago, I think, the Obama administration, in response to legislation passed by Congress, imposed sanctions on Venezuela. And they did it, and and it's pretty limited sanctions. It's targeted at seven individuals. But they did it using language that said, Venezuela is a threat to the national security of the United States. And their view was, oh, this is just boilerplate language. It's what we have to say when we impose these sanctions. But not only Venezuela, but every country in Latin America took offense at the notion that somebody is a threat to the national security of the United States, somebody in this hemisphere. And so that was a little bit of, the Obama administration went way forward in its relationship because of Cuba and then was set somewhat back because of Venezuela. But still, the overall tone of the whole thing was pretty positive.
Well, I definitely want to focus a bit in our discussion tonight on Venezuela-U.S. relations, but maybe you can speak to what are some of the other substantive issues that were taken up at the summit, including U.S.-Cuban relations. What of substance happened there that, could change things for the better?
So the key things were the presence of Cuban President Raul Castro. He and President Obama shook hands, stood in the States together, met privately, and talked about the issues that that need to be worked out in order for the U.S. to open a formal embassy in Cuba and vice versa. So that was the first and kind of biggest single thing. There were a series of discussions about Central America, especially, the three northern Central American countries, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, where last year there was this huge influx, huge uptick in unaccompanied minors and kids under 18 traveling by themselves and coming to the U.S. border. And the U.S. has asked the Congress for $1 billion to help respond to that crisis and help potentially maybe address some of the root causes that lead young people to flee. And the Central American presidents were talking about that. So that was kind of a second big issue. ongoing peace talks in Colombia, I think, was a very hopeful issue that a number of presidents discussed. And then there's a kind of ongoing set of issues about the economy in the hemisphere, energy issues in the hemisphere. And, you know, as always, I mean, kind of the glaring issue is Latin America is the most unequal, income-wise, the most unequal region in the world. And though things have gotten better in the last over the last decade, it continues to be the most, you know, has the greatest amount of inequity in the Western Hemisphere. And that's obviously an ongoing topic for discussion everywhere.
Jeff Thale, you've visited Cuba some 30 times in recent years.
Yeah.
You've really kept your pulse on what's happening in Cuba and U.S.-Cuban relations. What are the major obstacles that you see to full normalization between Washington and Havana?
Well, there's an immediate set and a long-term set. The immediate set is the United States has Cuba on a list of terrorist countries, and only three other countries are on that list: Iran, Syria, and Sudan. North Korea is not on that list. A number of other countries you could think of are not on that list. Cuba was put on that list in 1982. It was put on by the Reagan administration. It didn't, honestly speaking, have anything to do with terrorism. Cuba has never been a state sponsor of terror, but it had to do with Cuban support for revolutionary movements in Central America and the Reagan administration opposing that. So Cuba takes tremendous offense at being on that list, and the list has real implications. It makes it harder for Cuban businesses abroad to do banking and a whole set of problems. So taking Cuba off that list is a really important issue for the Cubans. That's first. And then the flip side, the U.S. Wants to ensure that when it opens an embassy in Cuba, Cuban citizens can visit it without any restrictions, and U.S. diplomats can travel anywhere on the island without any restrictions. And the Cuban government's a little nervous about that because historically, in their view, the U.S. has actively sponsored dissidents who are hostile to their government. So those two sets of issues have to be worked out. I think they're close to being worked out. I think a U.S. embassy will open in Cuba and a Cuban embassy in the United States in the next couple of months. That will actually be a tremendously exciting thing and a huge step forward in the relationship. But it's only a first step. I mean, Cuba and the United States have really deep and long-term differences. So over property, over the definition of elections, over the issue of human rights, over damage done by the U.S. embargo, and obviously the embargo itself. I mean, President Obama has move to expand travel and permit some limited trade, but it's still true there's no tourist travel to Cuba. U.S. citizens can go as tourists to North Korea, Iran, wherever, Syria, but we cannot go to Cuba, and that's still true even after all the president has done. And U.S. businesses can't, they can sell to the small and new private sector in Cuba, but they can't sell to or buy from or invest in the big state-run companies that are, you know, two-thirds of the Cuban economy. So ending the embargo is still a huge and ongoing issue. And then there are the really long-term issues like the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo that Cuba would like return to it. So there's a lot to be worked through here. But the first step is really the embassy-related issues, and that, I think, is under discussion now and probably be resolved in the next couple of months.
How big an obstacle is domestic political opposition to normalizing relations with Cuba from many of the conservative politicians in Washington, as well as the activist Cuban-American population in Florida and elsewhere around the country?
Yeah. So the Cuban-American community has really changed in the last decade. It used to be strongly pro-embargo, and voters in the Cuban American community used to be overwhelmingly pro-embargo. That's not as true as it used to be. I think that's a big part of why President Obama was able to make the changes he made. He either won or almost came very close to winning the Cuban American vote in the last election. And so I think that made him feel like he had more room to do this than he thought. At the same time, I think when he takes Cuba off the terrorist list, the sort of hardline Cuban Americans in the Congress and their allies are going to push back hard against that. And I think we'll see a big battle in the Congress with the other side trying to say Cuba is still a terrorist state and all that. So I think, you know, we're in better shape on that than we were a year ago or 5 years ago or 10, but there's still battles that are going to be fought over that issue in the next couple of years.
You know, one of the things brought up by opponents of normalization is the fact that some convicted felons have taken exile in Cuba, including Assata Shakur, otherwise known as Joanne Chesimard, who was convicted of a bank robbery of an armored truck, I think, in New Jersey, in the New Jersey Turnpike back in 1973. But on the flip side of that, you have Cuban-American Luis Posada Carriles, who has been accused and I think has even admitted that he's been involved in terrorist acts targeting Cuba, including the downing of a Cuban airliner.
Long history. He was involved by his own admission in bombing an airliner, setting a bomb in an airliner flying from Venezuela to Cuba that killed 73 people, including, I believe, a college fencing team. He was involved, and he admitted he was involved in hiring people to plant bombs in tourist hotels in Cuba, one of which killed an Italian tourist in the mid-90s. So, and he's got a long history. He's a long history with the CIA and the Iran-Contra operation, a whole set of what I think is pretty ugly things. He lives in South Florida. The George W. Bush administration, things were bad enough that even the George W. Bush administration tried to deport him. And he won a deportation battle on legal grounds, and so he's living quite freely and comfortably in South Florida. And it is my own guess is that if we were to find some way to deport him, the Cubans might be perfectly willing to make a trade for Joanne Chesimard or somebody like that, because I think their position is they offered her political asylum. And that's not something you simply revoke. And, you know, you can agree or disagree, and there are a lot of views about Assata Shakur, about Joanne Chesimard. But I just, as a practical matter, the likelihood that they would send her back to the United States without something like our sending back Luis Posada Carriles seems really low to me.
No, that sounds right to me. We're speaking with Jeff Thale, Program Director with the Washington Office on Latin America. He was in Panama City observing the historic Summit of the Americas that took place there this past weekend. And, Jeff, I wanted to talk a bit about U.S.-Venezuelan relations. As you said a moment ago, the U.S. government had recently designated the government of Nicolas Maduro, Venezuela's president, as a threat to U.S. national security. They imposed sanctions on 7 government officials. And I believe President Maduro brought with him 10.5 million petition signatures calling on President Obama to lift those economic sanctions.
Right. So this is... The Obama administration has been trying very hard for the last couple of years to, I think it made a smart decision. And the decision it made was, there's some real issues we have with Venezuela, but we are not in the position, we the United States are not really in the position to do anything public that's terribly helpful. And every public thing we do simply gets turned into kind of political fodder in one way or another in Venezuela itself. And so the U.S. has been trying very hard not to get itself injected publicly into Venezuelan politics. Last year, that's the view of the Obama administration and the State Department, I think. That's not the view of the majority in the Congress. And last year, driven by Venezuelan-American voters and donors in Miami and by kind of hardline opinion, Congress passed legislation requiring the Obama administration to impose sanctions on Venezuelan government officials. And so the administration didn't have any choice but to do this. And when they imposed these sanctions, they used the legal language they were required to use, which calls Venezuela a national security threat, that you have to invoke national security to impose these sanctions. But I don't think they understood at all or thought very much about the consequences of that. And it caused this huge reaction in Venezuela, as I said, and, you know, as you point out as well. It led President Maduro, whose popularity had been sinking, to say, we're being threatened by the United States, and his popularity has gone up, and 10.5 million people signed a petition calling for the overturning of these sanctions, and it raised U.S.-Venezuelan tensions very high, and it brought other countries in the hemisphere, sort of, who'd been fairly silent about issues in Venezuela, to line up with President Maduro and kind of attack the United, denounce the United States for calling Venezuela a national security threat. So, actually, at this summit, President Obama personally and senior members of the staff were trying really hard to go around and say, whatever we said is the technical letter of the law, we do not see Venezuela as a threat to the national security of the United States. I think President Obama was quoted as saying, we want to be friends with Venezuela. So I think they did the best they could to try and reduce those tensions, but clearly they can't reverse what they did, and they can't eliminate them. So that's going to be a continuing sore spot. I do have to say, one of my personal highlights watching the president speak at the summit, President Maduro wanted to assure people that he was not an opponent of the American people. And he said, I love a lot of things about the United States. And then he paused for a second, and he clearly was thinking. He said, matter of fact, I love Jimi Hendrix. I'd never expected a Latin American president to invoke Jimi Hendrix in explaining his views about the United States. So that was kind of a personal high point for me.
That's a great story. I like
that
a lot.
Great story.
Yeah, he's a favorite, I think, of a lot of people, including Nicolas Maduro. That's good to know. Hey, you know, I think what's missing in a lot of news coverage about the current tensions between the U.S. and Venezuela is the fact that the United States under George W. Bush, you know, was certainly an important participant in the coup d'etat that momentarily overthrew, the beloved previous president, Hugo Chavez, back in 2002. And, you know, there's a whole history of U.S. military interventions, coup d'etats, and support for dictators that I think really goes unnoted in a lot of the U.S. coverage of Latin American politics. So that when Nicolas Maduro cites, sanctions that says Venezuela is a security threat to the United States, it seems like a clear pretext for some kind of intervention, economic
right.
or military.
I think that's really right. I mean, I do not think the Obama administration is planning to invade Venezuela. But that said, Venezuela reacts the way it does, and much of Latin America reacts the way it does because of a long history of U.S. role in the hemisphere in general, and in particular in Venezuela, because there was a coup in 2002. Whether or not we formally organized it or sponsored it, we jumped to support it the moment it happened under the Bush administration. And so, I mean, I think Venezuelans have a recent history of the United States supporting coup d'etats and seeing Venezuela as a threat. And so from sitting here in the U.S., you say, oh, they just use this language. What is it? Just boilerplate, doesn't mean anything. Why are they reacting like this? And it's important to understand in Venezuela and in Latin America, when the U.S. says some country is a security threat, people take that. It's not surprising. People take that really seriously.
Yeah. Now, you know, I wanted to get your take on the larger issue here. There has been, you know, a real schism between the U.S. and Latin America in general for many years, especially since democracy took over a lot of these nations, ousting U.S.-supported dictators over the decades, both in terms of U.S. neoliberal economic policies that were foisted on Latin America that created a lot of economic havoc, and the military dictatorships. You know, there's a lot of bitter memories there among, you know, millions of people in Latin America. And how well do you think the Obama administration has done in terms of trying to heal those deep, deep wounds?
That's a good question. They, on the one side, you could say President Obama came into the summit able to say, I have addressed the immigration issues of, 4 million Mexicans and mostly Mexicans and Central Americans here, which no previous president has done. And I have been trying to close Guantanamo, the prison at Guantanamo, and I have just done this thing with Cuba, and I have really moved forward in a relationship. And I think that's true. at the same time, you know, there's this kind of ongoing problem with how we approach Venezuela, and there are continuing economic tensions in much of the hemisphere. You know, there's a set of sort of left and center-left governments in the hemisphere where I don't think the U.S. is trying to actively undermine them, but we certainly have a different set of economic priorities than them, and that's a source of continuing tension. I think that, you know, Brazil, which is the biggest, obviously, economy in the hemisphere, and sort of a main, you know, growing actor on the world stage, sees a lot of trade and economic issues differently than the United States does. So I think the Obama administration has made progress and reduced tension, but, you know, the differences in priorities and emphasis between the United States and much of Latin America are real and are going to continue.
Just one more thing on Venezuela. It's been important in terms of solidarity of many of these left and progressive governments around the hemisphere that Venezuela, the oil-rich country, you know, certainly has one of the largest deposits of oil reserves of any country in the world. They've supported a lot of countries throughout the hemisphere, including those smaller nations in the Caribbean, with free oil or bartered oil or really highly discounted oil, and that includes Cuba, of course. But with the price of oil dipping, it's sure to cause a lot of dislocation. What is it that you can say about Venezuela and its place there?
I mean, you're clearly right. The Venezuela provided subsidized, like very generous terms for oil to Cuba, especially, but to much of the Caribbean, about half of Central America and some other countries in the northern coast of Latin America. So people were deeply, I mean, that's a very, you know, you have to, did they have foreign policy reasons for doing so? Sure. But is that, was that a good thing to do? The answer is that yes, right? I mean, it's undoubtedly yes. And many countries are deeply grateful to Venezuela because of that. Falling price of oil makes it much harder for Venezuela to continue doing that. I think that is going to cause economic challenges in, especially in the Caribbean, in Nicaragua. It will be a problem for Cuba as well. So I don't think those countries are going to lose their affection for what Venezuela did for them, but they are going to have to figure out new sources of financing and how they adjust to, I mean, oil itself will be cheaper, but they're still going to have financing problems buying it. So there's going to be a whole set of shifts and dislocations there for a lot of countries.
Right. And, you know, a lot of the oil market's been manipulated by OPEC countries, including, of course, Saudi Arabia, to drive competitors out of business. I mean, it's hard to know where the price of oil is going to be next year, but...
Yeah. Right, and it's clearly true that the price, the Saudi Arabians are trying for their own market share reasons to keep the price low the moment. So, yeah.
It's a complex market, and it's hard to predict.
Yeah.
But, Jeff, before we go, I wanted to get your take on one important issue that I know was discussed at the Summit of the Americas in Panama, and that was the ongoing negotiations between the FARC guerrilla movement in Colombia and the Colombian government. The talks brokered in Havana, Cuba, for some time now. What is the outlook for those talks?
I actually think the outlook is... surprisingly positive. I think that the people in our office who closely follow those talks, and I, you know, from what you hear at the summit as well, believe that the odds are better than 50-50 that by sometime early next year, the Colombian government and the FARC will finalize the last issues and sign a peace agreement. And that will be, that's a historic thing for Colombia and for the region. I think the FARC will, there's sort of a set of human rights and transitional justice issues that are very difficult. They're going to have to be worked out because of historic kind of human rights issues and cases on both sides. I think they're going to look at the model for paramilitary demobilization. They're going to look at South Africa. They're going to look at a number of models. That's going to be a tough one. But I think that will ultimately get resolved. I think there will be a peace accord. I think the FARC will become a political party. And that will be a big step forward. I mean, there will still be a lot of issues. Poverty and inequity is still a huge and ongoing problem in Colombia. Displacement, particularly of Afro-Colombians, is a huge issue. So those things won't disappear, but they may be able to be addressed in a context in which there's greater political openness and more room to for progressive forces to kind of push things through. So I think it's relatively an optimistic scenario at the moment.
And that civil war has been going on some 50 years, right?
It's 50 years, right.
It's probably one of the longest-running civil wars in world history.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Jeff. I appreciate you making time to come on the program tonight to talk about the Summit of the Americas and what you saw and heard down there. And we'll look forward to staying in touch on some of these issues that you're following, especially with U.S.-Cuba relations. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, well, I'm hopeful about that, so I have my fingers crossed, and we'll see where it goes. But thank you very much for calling, and I'm happy to talk to you.
Thanks, Jeff. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
That's Jeff Thale, Program Director with the Washington Office on Latin America.